From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made yesterday afternoon during Governor Andrew Cuomo's press briefing. During that briefing, the governor didn't hold back in expressing concerns about a sharp one-day rise in coronavirus cases in New York City. The city saw its infection rate move from 1.93% to over 3% in just 24 hours. A surge in cases has been seen in specific clusters in Brooklyn, Orange County, Rockland County, and the Southern Tier. Even though the 10 zip codes with the highest percentage of cases only make up 2% of the state's population, they contribute now to 25% of the state's new positive cases. Here in the Monroe County and Finger Lakes region, this case rate remains around 1%. But should we expect numbers to start moving upward? What does the surge in cases downstate mean for upstate? Our guests this hour are going to discuss the state of the pandemic locally. It's been a little while since we've talked about how we see the pandemic in our city, in our county, and in our region, including what we know about community spread, who has been contracting the virus, how we're doing containing it and treating it. First, I'll welcome Dr. Nana Bennett. Dr. Bennett is professor of medicine and public health sciences at the University of Rochester Medical Center, the founder and director of the Center for Community Health and Prevention, and co-director of the Clinical and Translational Science Institute. Dr. Bennett, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much. Great to be with you.
In a moment here, we're going to hear from your colleague, but let me just start by asking you briefly, are we making too much of what the governor revealed yesterday about the spike in cases, particularly in New York City, or is that a red flag for you?
I think it's a bit of a red flag for all of us. That's not to say that we'll necessarily follow downstate, but, you know, New York's not a giant state, and there is spread from one community to another community. So I think it's a good warning sign and a reminder that we need to keep doing what we're doing.
There's a lot more to discuss with Dr. Bennett. I'm going to turn to a conversation I had this morning with Dr. Emil Lesho, who is an infectious disease physician and epidemiologist at Rochester Regional Health. And I started by asking Dr. Lesho that same question. When we look at New York City, is there a concern about what it portends for us?
The same can happen here. So it just because, you know, people travel. In the first case in the Rochester region back in March, around March 12th or March 13th, was from a person who had taken a Greyhound bus from the New York City region through Rochester on their way to Buffalo. It was very shortly after that we had the first community onset case. And coronavirus, the SARS-CoV-2, the agent that causes it, is fairly, as you can see, can rapidly, semi-exponentially increase the number of cases. You know, when if you have one case transmitting it to 2 to 4 people, then those 2 to 4, you have 4 to 8 and 16 and so on. I think it's a cautionary tale for up here. People are not static. People don't stay in one location. Viruses are not, you know, beholden to any geographic border. I've had patients that we've taken care of at this hospital several times who have returned from travel with COVID. You know, some survived, some didn't.
Earlier this week when those numbers were released, there was this, among some in Rochester, there was this feeling of, well, I told you so. This was going to happen when schools reopen or when the economy reopens. And if it's happening in New York City, it's inevitably going to come here. So I take the point on what can travel, but it certainly doesn't strike me as inevitable that if New York City sees a resurgence that we would see a resurgence, is it?
I agree. We don't have to be fatalist. It's not inevitable. But I look at it as a cautionary tale. If, you know, and you originally opened up, the first question was, what is the community picture up here? Fortunately, the percent positive cases in Monroe County is low. It's below 1%. You know, if you listeners can track this themselves on the Monroe County Medical Society dashboard or the County Health Department dashboard, and you could see the number, the raw number of new cases each day, the percent positive each day, the total number of cases. So very fortunately, we're still below 1%, which is a very good place to be when you have school opening. So, and what may be contributing to the downstate situation may be localized to certain cultural practices. I know the Orthodox Jewish community sometimes feels that they're being singled out unfairly, but some of their cultural practices, if they're not wearing masks, if they host large gatherings, and I'm not singling any one community out. We've seen throughout the news teenagers having parties, adults having parties, but it may not be inevitable here. You're correct.
Okay. And regarding those testing rates, I spent all summer reading writers like Michael Mina from Harvard, the epidemiologist who's been using the Atlantic Monthly platform as one platform to call for the rapid antigen testing, what some people might call saliva testing. And I think there's a lot of confusion about how inevitable that may be and what that might allow us to do or whether that's even coming. What's your expectation with that?
My understanding is that the saliva test has been recently approved by the Food and Drug Administration. Like many things with COVID-19, this is new territory, uncharted waters. So we have to see, once it's road tested on a longer term in the healthcare environment, the performance characteristics of that test. The advantage of that test is it enables patients easily to produce their own sample, to collect their own sample. They basically spit in a cup. It's not as particularly sensitive as the swab up the nose, the molecular test, or the what's called the PCR, but it's useful for certain settings. And again, as you were alluding to, the percent positive tests, what percent you will see depends on the subgroup of patients that you're testing. If you're testing symptomatic patients or patients that have symptoms that could be consistent with COVID, you would expect to see a little higher positivity rate than when you're testing asymptomatic patients. Increasingly, I know Rochester Regional Health, we're testing everybody that gets admitted to the hospital. We're testing everybody that's having a surgery. And these, for the most part, are asymptomatic patients. So we're doing more tests. So even though we're doing more tests, the percent positive has not gone up, which is a good thing, but we're testing asymptomatic patients as well. And so that's important for epidemiologic reasons, for contact tracing, but the type of patients that you're giving a test to can affect what's called the positive predictive value and other test characteristics.
I think there has been a great deal of misunderstanding in recent weeks about what comorbidities mean. And there was, we had a couple of weeks in which there was a lot of discussion about, something like 94% of COVID deaths have come with at least one or two comorbidities. And I couldn't believe, I'll be honest, Dr. Lesch, I couldn't believe how many people I saw say, then those aren't really COVID deaths.
I would disagree with that. What there is excess attributable mortality. Those patients with, for example, morbid obesity with chronic conditions would not, the way you look at it from epidemiologic reporting is what is the excess mortality due to the event? Due to the 1918 pandemic, you have excess mortality. Due to COVID, you have the excess mortality. So you're looking at a cluster of patients. If a patient that has, for example, cardiovascular disease dies with COVID, there but for without the COVID, that patient would still be alive. So that is because of COVID. I think another misunderstanding is just because you don't die doesn't mean you can't get very sick. We're hearing reports more frequently of young, healthy people who are having, you hear these long haulers, what are called people that have residual side effects, residual symptoms from having recovered from COVID. Granted, there's many infections that are asymptomatic, but I'll say again, many young patients don't have full insurance coverage. Can they really afford to spend a week in the hospital or a few days even in an ICU? So we have to keep in mind, just because we don't die doesn't mean we can't get very sick. And just because we don't get very sick needing an ICU doesn't guarantee us from having long-term side effects from the disease.
How much better are we at treating COVID for patients who end up in the hospital with COVID?
I think we're considerably better. I don't know why. And you have to caveat that because this is like observation, like anecdotal observations. And I think my colleagues and I every day wonder, Are we seeing less deaths because we're better at treating, even though we really have no proven definitive treatments yet? Or is there something about the virus? You know, viruses change. They mutate. They can get weaker, or they can get stronger. They can get more contagious. They can get less contagious, or various combinations. So, yes. But I think as we collect the data and do the epidemiologic analysis, we can see what this apparent reduction in mortality is due to. I should clarify, just because there's no proven randomized controlled treatments yet, there are many in the pipeline. And number two, as is for many infections without antibiotics or antivirals or directed anti-infectives, what's very important is supportive care. And the critical care teams and the hospitalists have gotten very much better. I wouldn't say they got better because that implies they were bad to begin with. They learned a lot. You may have heard how they position people on their stomachs, what's called proning. They have learned a lot of nuances about the timing of when to use the breathing tube, invasive ventilation versus non-invasive ventilation. They've learned a lot how to use anti-inflammatories and what types of patients best benefit from steroids, from antiviral, the remdesivir, from the plasma, from recovered patients. That's called convalescent plasma. So short answer is I'd say yes.
And finally, as we head towards the colder months, you know, we are not Texas or Florida or California. We don't have the advantage of going through December, January, February, March, and being able to sit outside and dine all the time unless, you know, we want to bundle up. And maybe people will do that. But for the most part, we are facing the cold weather months in the Northeast in what will be a very different sort of feeling scenario in this pandemic. And I'm wondering if you're concerned about complacency, if people are used to gathering outside and they're just going to continue to gather even if it's indoors, and if you do expect a significant recurrence in cases.
Yes, not only myself, but I would imagine a lot of people in public health or infection control and infectious disease are concerned about complacency. Again, anecdotally and just observation, informal observations, I see. I think we're doing a very good job overall. I think the community, the use of masks throughout, and I congratulate and I encourage people to continue to do that in social distance. But every now and then, you know, I was at the pharmacy the other day, person didn't have a mask on. We allow visitors now in the hospital, and every now and then we see visitors come in without masks. That's fairly dangerous. So we're worrying about fatigue, about isolation fatigue, about mask fatigue. We especially worry about that as the weather's getting cold. You know, it was said that, oh, it'll go away when it's warm. That didn't happen in the South. Maybe one of the things that happened in the South was that as it got so hot, more and more people went indoors for the air conditioning. And that may have contributed to the big outbreaks that we've seen in Florida and Texas and California. Well, that's going to happen up here when people go indoors for the winter. So we worry about that. There are factors as temperature and humidity, which may make the virus weaker or stronger, or some effects cancel the other ones out. But we're watching that. We're all very concerned about that. We're hoping that the flu season, you know, this is a very important time to remind everybody, it's crucial that people get their flu shot this year. If you know, cases are going up of the COVID, if the hospitals get overwhelmed with COVID and flu, it's going to be very hard to take good care of patients. So we're trying to protect our ability to take care of patients by preventing as much preventable disease as possible. And that's why it's so important to get the flu shot.
Sure.
And the symptoms of either are very similar. They're almost indistinguishable without a lab test. So you come to me with a body aches, a fever, a cough, I can't, you know, reliably say based on one or two symptoms alone that that's either the flu or COVID.
So do you expect then that it's too early for people to already be making conversations and plans to either scale back, cancel holiday plans? I mean, are you planning on scaling back?
Oh, yes. My family and I mean, we'd love to visit our families out of state, you know, out of town, but we're not going to do that. We have vulnerable elderly family members. It's going to be not – I would encourage the listeners to look at the link from the CDC about safe recommendations for holiday gatherings. It's very helpful. It's very useful. It talks about Halloween, the Day of the Dead, Thanksgiving. It proposes some safer alternatives to those things, but large gatherings are opportunities for spread. So I would encourage the listeners to be careful.
That's Dr. Emil Lesho, who is an infectious disease physician and epidemiologist at Rochester Regional Health. Our thanks to him. And I'm joined by Dr. Nancy Bennett. Dr. Bennett is a professor of medicine and public health sciences at the University of Rochester Medical Center, founder and director of the Center for Community Health and Prevention, co-director of the Clinical and Translational Science Institute. And listeners, if you've got questions, just in general about how Dr. Bennett sees the state of the pandemic, and we can address a number of different points. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. All right, Dr. Bennett, there's a lot there. When you look at where we were in March, then April into May, into the summer, how much better do you think we are at treating COVID?
I'm not an expert in treatment, but I would agree with Dr. Lesho that we are getting better in treatment. The way that I measure that is we look at the case fatality rate, and what that means is the percentage of people among all of those who've been infected who die. And back in the beginning of the pandemic, that percentage was about 7% in our community, and it's now closer to 5%. So I think we are definitely doing better. I think there are a lot of different reasons for that. Some of it has to do with the quality of the care, probably, and just getting to know this virus better, know how it happens and how it works and how we can combat it. It may also have to do with some changes in the demographics of who's becoming infected. So we are seeing younger people more than we did at the beginning of the epidemic, and they may be a little bit healthier, so they may be less likely to die. But I think it's important to emphasize that a death rate of 7% is very high, and that makes this disease very dangerous.
Talking to Dr. Bennett, who is, frankly, in our eyes, brilliant, and we're so grateful for the time to discuss this. And we've got some phone calls. We'll get to those in just a second here. But I want to talk to you about, what we see. You know, maybe what concerns you the most as we head toward the winter, Dr. Bennett, because from my perspective, we have been in a little bit of, I'm not saying people aren't serious. Obviously, people are serious, and people are used to masking, people are used to distancing. But I think with the warm weather and with how successful this community has been at getting our numbers down, I think there's this idea that, well, we've got this thing figured out, we can live in many ways as normal-ish. We can have schools open, we can have businesses open. I'm worried about the psychic and the psychological impact of another resurgence. And it doesn't feel inevitable to me, as both you and Dr. Lesho have said, but it certainly feels possible as we go into the winter. Take me through, what you might see as kind of a worst-case scenario.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think we are at a really critical point. Just to put this in some context, we had about five times as many cases daily back in May than we do now. We have done an incredible job as a community of shutting down, wearing masks, being really careful. But we have to keep doing it. And you mentioned before the concern about complacency. I think it's complacency, and it's also just how hard it is. We had a death in our family recently, and we had to struggle with mourning the person who died, but also keeping our entire family safe from one another. And that is not a minor undertaking, mm-hmm. as we learned. And I think that every single family in this community is going through that, you know, whether it's a wedding or a funeral or just wanting to see your grandchildren because you haven't been able to. So I think that the community has done an amazing job. But what's really hard is that we have to keep doing it. And with the cold weather, it's going to be much more difficult. I think people are going to really need to think about alternatives, whether it's taking a walk with your family member outside rather than getting together for dinner, or whether it's actually doing, you know, sitting outside with people, getting a heater so you can be on your back porch all winter. I don't know what kinds of solutions we're going to come up with. It's all a bit of an experiment, but we have to keep socially distancing. We have to keep wearing masks. We have to keep washing our hands. And I think for kids, this is really, really painful and difficult. For kids, parents, teachers, kids are meant to be together. And I think that this community is doing a very powerful job of trying to think about how children can go back to school at least a little bit safely. And, you know, we're just going to have to see how it goes and keep our fingers crossed that we can do this in a safe manner.
All right, let me take some phone calls. I've got plenty of questions for Dr. Bennett, but I'll turn to our listeners who are lined up. And Dr. Bennett is certainly adept at pointing out where her expertise lies and where she's sort of relaying what she's talked about with colleagues. But we're grateful for the time. So let's get Sandy in Rochester first. Go ahead, Sandy.
Yes, hi, doctors. I did have COVID. I had it in August, the very beginning of August. It lasted about 10 days, 2 weeks, never hospitalized, but it was rough. I have had two negative tests. I called the Red Cross. They approved me to give convalescent plasma, which I'm going to do next week. They said that I could do that repeatedly while I have the immunities. My question is, how long do you think the immunities will last? Now, on the second part of a question is, we have our family is seven people in two households within a mile of each other. So we saw each other before as safely as we could. But out of those two households, myself and my daughter both had it at the same time. That's her household. Her spouse and my spouse did not get it. My granddaughter had, she was asymptomatic. So I'm just wondering if we have the immunities and the people that we live with didn't get it, what's your take on that?
Yes, Sandy, I'll let Dr. Bennett, can you hang on the line for a sec, Sandy?
Sure.
Okay, thanks. Go ahead, Dr. Bennett.
Okay, well, first let me say I'm so sorry you had to live through that. I understand from people who've had COVID that it is a really severe illness, even if they're not hospitalized. So I'm glad you recovered well and sorry you went through that. And secondly, congratulations on being a donor. It is incredibly critical to give blood during this time, but also if you do have antibodies, it's extremely helpful in the treatment of other people. So that's wonderful, and you should be honored for your generosity in doing that. In terms of the how long immunity will last, we really don't know. We do know that antibodies, which is what you were tested for and which were positive, and thus they would like to use your serum for treatment, the antibodies seem to go away in many people relatively quickly. That is, you know, 3-4 months after illness. What we don't know is whether people remain immune because they have cellular memory. And we just don't know the answer to that question yet. So what that means is maybe you don't have any antibodies in your blood anymore, but you might have the memory in your cells so that when confronted with the virus again, you could quickly make antibodies. But we just don't know the answer to that question yet. And then lastly, your question about household spread and the fact that some people in your household got the illness and some people did not. It's very difficult. We don't know as much as we would like to know about transmission. We do know that, you know, being in the presence of someone who has the illness, be they symptomatic or asymptomatic, for a period of time will result in infection. But not in all cases. Some people may have some residual memory of some sort to coronavirus, which might play a role. It's possible that they become infected and you don't know it because they're asymptomatic. There are really a variety of scenarios one can imagine occurred in your household. But I think you can't assume that everyone in your household is immune. And I think that means that you have to maintain the same precautions, even though some of you did become ill and probably are immune right now. But because we don't know how long that lasts, we just have to still keep being careful.
Sandy, what were the symptoms like for you?
Well, it started with a fever, pretty severe. That lasted one day, and then it went away the next. But the following day, the third day, it came back with a vengeance and lasted probably 5 days in a row. I had what I call COVID fog, like a brain fog. And I also had some upset stomach. I had the lack of taste and smell when it did come, not smell so much, taste more than smell. When it did come back, it was salt and sweet for a long time. But those were primarily the symptoms. Oh, and fatigue, horrible fatigue. Mm-hmm. Like if I was able to take a shower, I had to go right back to bed.
Hmm. Did you find yourself thinking, where did this come from? I mean, a lot of people we've talked to who end up getting diagnosed with COVID say, but I was so careful. I thought I was doing what I was supposed to be doing. How did you feel?
Well, it's true. I mean, I was careful. I work in the healthcare system. I feel confident the correct precautions are taken at the clinic where I work. So, and no one else had it, as far as I know, although we tried to keep it on the down low, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And my daughter works in a city court, and she, in the same way, felt like she wasn't around anybody who had it. They're very limited contact with people without nothing without wearing masks. They're sanitizing, all that. My granddaughter, who was asymptomatic, also serves at a restaurant. There were no cases through that restaurant. Mm. But they, everyone in our family was the hand sanitizer, the face masks, washing solid items when they came into the house, the Amazon packages and so forth, limited contact on the outside. We didn't even, you know, grocery store was limited, did a lot of Instacart, that kind of thing. So,
yeah.
You know, wipe down the gas hose.
Yeah, no,
it's
a mystery. I mean, a friend of mine, Sandy, who is a doctor, said, you know, if the virus could glow like phosphorus, we'd be surprised how often we would sort of walk past it in public, because there's probably more of it than we realize. But it's very hard to trace it. And I'm just glad to hear that. I'm glad to hear that, you know, you came through it. And then I wish you well. Thank you for making the time to call, and good luck to you, Sandy.
All right. I want to add one more
thing.
Even though they say I have the immunities, I'm still taking the same precautions.
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
<That's> good.
Thank you, Sandy.
We salute you.
Thank you.
A couple of points that Sandy made before I turn to some other callers, Dr. Bennett. It does seem to me that this question of antibodies, this is one of the big mysteries to crack here. I mean, everybody wants to know, not only did I have it, but if I have antibodies, how long do they last? And do you need T cells? And how much value do antibodies bring in this particular disease? And everything that I'm hearing sort of lines up with what I've heard from experts like yourself over recent months, which is that we still have to learn. We don't know what we need to know in full. But there isn't much of a reason yet to think that there's something dramatically different about COVID and this coronavirus. It's just we need the evidence, and it does seem to me that that would be a big mystery to crack.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And there are a number of studies going on trying to look at this, these questions. But, you know, if you think about it, we've only really been dealing with coronavirus for 6 months. And that's a very short period of time to learn as much as we need to learn. And we've learned a lot, but there still is a great deal that we don't understand. And I think it'll be interesting because the vaccine trials are going on now. And as you might imagine, all of the vaccine trials measure antibody response to the vaccine. So we will probably learn a lot from these trials about antibody as well.
And the other point that I wanted to address with you that came up in Sandy's phone call is surfaces. first of all, I mean, I would guess there's nothing wrong with taking extra precautions during a pandemic. I mean, extra is better than fewer. We do seem to have more evidence that surface spread is not quite as high concern as we might have thought in March. That doesn't mean it can't spread on surfaces. But I'm curious to know, I mean, are you washing down every package, every piece of mail, every piece of, that comes from the grocery store?
God, do I really have to answer that? I have to admit I'm not. However, I do tend to wash my hands after I open a package, mm-hmm. and I tend to try to get a package out of my house as quickly as possible. I do tend to treat things from the outside world as, you know, as potentially infectious, but I'm not as careful as it sounds like Sandy was.
No, I hear that. And I think it's heartening to know that the surface spread is not as concerning as we would have thought. Again, doesn't mean it's zero. I'm still very, very good at opening doors with my elbow and my mm-hmm. hip and my shoulder. And, you know, so I think we've all made a lot of different changes here. So, let's...
I do think that the... You know, if you can't do everything the way Sandy described, then the most important really is to keep physical distance from other mm-hmm. people who you don't know or who you don't know are you know, could be potentially infectious.
Let me get Rich and Lisa after our only break of the hour. We're going to take that break and we'll come back to your phone calls. I'm curious to know, we've got some questions from listeners about the confidence in vaccines. In fact, it came up at the presidential debate last night. Dr. Bennett shouldn't worry. I'm not going to make her weigh in on politics. We all had enough of that last night. But I'm curious to know how she feels about just kind of what we're seeing in terms of speed of vaccine and what a comfortable, I don't know if there's such a thing as a comfortable speed during a pandemic, but we'll address that and a lot more with Dr. Nana Medic coming up here. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections. If you tried to watch the first presidential debate, and you are like many Americans, you couldn't get through all of it. Do you think there should be more debates? There are two more presidential debates on the schedule, and there is already talk of cancellation. Is it time to end this format, or at least this time around? Or do you want to see more? We debate the merits of it on Thursday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Rich in Rochester next on the phone. Hi, Rich. Go ahead.
Hello, Evan. How are you doing today?
Good. Go ahead.
I was going to ask a question. You just touched on it. On the antigens, and I mean, how long are they going to last? Because there's some questions of maybe how long will they be effective and will they be long-lasting? And if not, how will that affect the regimen of vaccines?
Okay, and I think, Dr. Bennett, antigen and antibody, let's make sure we understand the difference here. But if you want to address some of what Rich is saying, go ahead, Dr. Bennett.
Sure. So just to clarify, so an antigen is a part of a virus, essentially. So it's something that the body recognizes as different, and it's not just viruses, it's other things as well. So it's something that stimulates antibody production. And antibodies are proteins in our body that attach to antigens, that is that foreign thing that's in your body. And antibodies then set off a cascade of immunologic and complicated system that removes that foreign thing from your body. So the antibodies are the body's response. The antigen is the thing that causes the antibodies to attack it. In terms of vaccines, you know, again, we really don't know how long the impact of a vaccine would last. There are a whole series of vaccines that are under study right now. Those studies started as far back as, I guess, probably April, May, something like that. So there have been studies going on for a little while now. And studies of vaccines occur in three phases. Phase one is really looking at the safety of the vaccine and may also look at the dosage. phase two involves more people, and they look at the antibody production and, again, safety. And then phase three, our study is really trying to look at whether or not the vaccine works. So in phase three studies, people actually have to, you know, get sick before we know whether it works or not. And we look to see if the vaccine prevents people from becoming sick. So these studies are underway now. There are, I think, three vaccines that are in phase three studies. We should be starting to hear some results probably by the end of the year, maybe sooner. What scientists will be looking at is, number one and most important, the safety of these vaccines. And then number two, do they prevent people from becoming ill with COVID? And as part of that, you know, looking at whether or not they prevent people from becoming ill, they will be looking at both antibody production, but also cellular immunity. And sadly, it will be quite a while before we know how long the immunity from a vaccine lasts.
Okay. Rich, does that help?
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Okay. Rich, thank you. Dr. Bennett, are you comfortable with the pace that you're seeing and what we can expect?
You know, I think there have been a lot of politics injected into this process, which really is hard for those of us who work in science to see. But I also think that the studies are proceeding in a very legitimate and robust way. I think things have been sped up where they can be sped up, but I don't think they're being sped up in the places where they can't be. So, for example, those phases I just described are actually happening, and we are looking very carefully at safety as we go along. So I think if anything gets shortchanged, it's potentially going to be whether or not the vaccine is effective for a long period of time, because we won't know that for a long period of time. But I think that the scientific community has come together. As you probably know, a number of the vaccine companies have come together and signed a pact saying that they are not going to cut any corners in developing these vaccines. And I think that should be really reassuring to all of us. In addition, there are many, many scientists who are looking at this process very, very closely. And I can tell you that across the country, there's a great deal of discussion among scientists. And I think there's really a firm stance that we're going to make sure this is a safe and good vaccine.
Okay. Lisa in Irondequoit. Go ahead, Lisa.
Hi. My question for the doctor. I read an article not long ago, maybe not even a week ago. I didn't read the whole thing, but the gist of it was this: that the WHO really screwed up, and that there were not nearly as many deaths due to COVID as have been reported. And I also believe it said something like, it's unless there is an underlying condition, that it just isn't as deadly as we have believed. I even saw a headline from CNN that said, how could the WHO have screwed up so badly?
So
now, again, I didn't read the whole thing. I should have fact-checked it, but
okay.
I don't know. I mean, who the hell knows really from one minute to the next?
No. Look, there's always going to be changing information, and the World Health Organization has been criticized for especially how they've communicated on a number of issues, including masking. But
definitely.
But Lisa, you know, this is one of the things we talked about with Dr. Lesho, and I'm going to be curious in a moment to hear Dr. Bennett on this. But Lisa, when you hear that most of the people who've died from COVID had at least one or two comorbidities, does that make you think, well, that's probably what they died from?
No, I feel if I had COVID and I, you know, if I had diabetes, but then I got COVID and I got really, really sick, that I would have died from COVID.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. I mean, I have a comorbidity. And I'm a...
If that's what you mean by a comorbidity.
Yeah, right.
Did I answer you correctly? Okay.
Yeah, right. Because... So I have one of a long list of comorbidities. I'm a decently fit person, but I don't know if I would be impacted differently by this virus. And my concern, Lisa, was that when people see that story, a lot of people don't even know if they have comorbidities until they show up in the hospital. I didn't want, number one, people thinking, well, I'm relatively healthy, this doesn't affect me. I can let my guard down, or I don't want people thinking, well, that's why all these people died. They all, you know, there was obesity, et cetera. That is not at all the case. And yeah. I just wanted to make sure that I understood your question for Dr. Bennett. So let's go ahead. Let's get Dr. Bennett on this. Go ahead, Dr. Bennett.
Yeah. Let me just point out that there have been almost 6,000 cases of this virus in Monroe County alone. I mean, that's a huge number, and you know what the numbers are nationally as well. And there have been 300 deaths in this community alone from this virus, and 1,000 hospitalizations. And I think it's important to note that it is true that having chronic disease makes you at higher risk of being hospitalized and also of dying. However, not having chronic disease does not protect you. We just did a review of patients who were admitted to the hospital who were under 50 who had COVID, and almost 20% of them had no underlying conditions. Okay. So I say that again.
Yeah.
I mean, it is really important to recognize that this is a very severe virus. This is a virus that lands people in the hospital, even if they're under 50 years old and have no comorbid conditions. So we need to be clear about that. It's not that you're not right, that those chronic conditions and age especially increases your risk of having severe disease and death. But not having those things does not protect you. And sadly, we don't know what it is that makes some young people get very sick and even die. So it's a, and the other thing about the death rate question is that when we talk about COVID deaths, we're mostly talking about deaths that have been documented to occur in people who have tested positive for COVID. And so they are really due to COVID itself. However, there's also, we also look at excess death rates. I think you mentioned it in the earlier segment, actually, but what we've seen is this pretty large increase in death rates across the country, some of which are unattributed to COVID, but they're a big increase over what you would have expected to see a year ago. So we know people are dying of COVID. I mean, there is no question about it.
Yeah, and make sure, if I'm a student of yours, Dr. Bennett, make sure I'm explaining this right. So when we talk about excess deaths, we're talking about, you can take a frame of time, often it's in a given month compared to previous months, sometimes it's a year, how many people typically die of all ages, of all causes, and then you see the excess number, which just means how many more above the average is it. My understanding is the excess deaths just about everywhere are even higher than the official number of COVID deaths. In other words, we don't know that they're all COVID deaths, but the pandemic is, number one, a lot of people who have died in the excess deaths category have died of COVID. There could be people who have died because of other factors, maybe exacerbated by the pandemic. But the bottom line is COVID is responsible for a whole hell of a lot of cases, well over 200,000, and that number that we're looking at every day may even be undercounting. Is that fair?
Yeah. The number we're looking at on daily is in almost certainty undercounting, because as you said, if you compare the number of deaths that have occurred over the summer, for example, to the number of deaths that occur in an average summer, we've seen a huge increase, and greater than the number of deaths that we know are due to COVID.
When we look at the demographics, there's been a lot of analysis since the start of this pandemic about, in various geographic locations, sometimes higher disparities than others in regards to race, who is impacted, certainly age, and we understand that, socioeconomics. What do we know? Do we know what that picture looks like in our community?
Yeah, we actually do know a lot about what that picture looks like in our community. We have really great data sources, and that's been very, very helpful. It's important to note that 40% of the deaths in our community have been in those 85 or older. In addition, about 40% or 50% of the deaths have occurred in people who've been in long-term care. Very few deaths have occurred. Only about 3 deaths have occurred in those under the age of 50. So definitely age is a critical factor here. The other thing that we've seen are racial disparities, but when you look very, very closely at our data, it's been very interesting because what we're seeing is that African Americans and Latinx communities have been impacted with much higher rates of infection than whites. However, once infected, their risk of being admitted to the hospital and their risk of dying is exactly the same as whites. So the real problem is exposure and contracting the infection with respect to racial disparities.
Is there a policy solution? Is there a recourse for that?
Well, you know, we try to think about what the cause of that might be, and obviously it doesn't have anything to do with race. That's just a proxy for looking at different groups. But what it probably does have to do with is a number of factors. People of different races are at higher likelihood of being a essential worker. They are also are more likely to live in crowded and environmentally challenged neighborhoods. Those may be contributing. We know that racism itself contributes to poor health status. So there are a number of factors that may be contributing. But when we look at the fact that it's really a question of being exposed and contracting the virus as opposed to some other issue that's impacting their clinical course, you know, it makes me think this is really preventable. So it's really a question of making sure people don't get exposed and don't get infected to begin with.
Talking to Dr. Bennett for a few more minutes before the hour's up here, and I asked Dr. Lesho about this. I've been cautioned by some doctors, you know, that right now, end of September, we're a month from Halloween, 2 months from Thanksgiving, 3 months from Christmas and New Year's, and obviously colder as we go. And I've been cautioned by some doctors, you know, Halloween we can talk about. It's a little early to talk about Thanksgiving and Christmas because there's so much we don't know about what our rates are going to look like at that point, what testing capacity and even rapid antigen testing may look like or not. So it's hard to kind of offer guidelines now. But clearly Dr. Lesher thinks we need to have those conversations and not wait until we're a week out. I mean, have those conversations with family saying, what are your expectations? You know, all things being equal, we're not going to do it the same way. That's going to be hard for people. Do you agree with Dr. Lesher on that? I mean, is this time to at least start addressing this?
Absolutely. I think he's completely correct about this. First of all, we usually all make plans for Thanksgiving, Christmas, et cetera, relatively far ahead because people travel and so forth. And I think that we all have to acknowledge that we're not going to be able to do things the way we normally do this year. And I think it means foregoing the big Christmas party, you know, or holiday party that we usually hold, or it means not having relatives visit from out of town. And I think, you know, I think we all need to think of clever ways to make it still celebratory, but not put ourselves at risk. And I think this is a hard conversation. I think it's very difficult to discuss this. You know, you have to say to someone, so what are your, exactly what you said, what are your expectations? And, you know, you have to share your own concerns or fears about this disease. You know, I find myself having a really hard time asking people to put on a mask when I see someone without a mask. And it's kind of obvious, but it feels invasive. And I think we all have to get more used to talking about these issues. And I also think we have to acknowledge the loneliness that this will cause.
Mm-hmm. I mean, loneliness on a daily and weekly basis, and then we think about the holidays. So it's certainly complex. I think I want to close with you on this, and I really don't even care if this sounds Pollyanna, but the governor of Kentucky, I thought, has said some really important things about how to deal with this pandemic. And he said the way we're going to beat this pandemic is with kindness. And what he means by that is with empathy for people who are struggling, with kindness to those who are trying to do the right thing, with kindness and love for those scared about their businesses, worried about what the next winter is going to look like, instead of judgment, anger all the time. If everybody adopted a sort of a loving and kind pose toward one another, that we'd have a better shot here. Do you agree with that?
Totally. There's no question. I mean, we just can't be being critical of each other and being judgmental. We have to share our concerns, share our feelings, and, you know, help everyone around us to take the precautions they need to take to stay healthy.
I'm always grateful for your time, and thank you for these updates. And here's to hoping that as we move into this fall and winter, when it gets a little more raw out there, that you know, that we avoid the worst of it and that we can kind of move through this successfully. This community, led by people like you, Dr. Brennan, has done a remarkable job since March. Thank you for making the time to come back and talk to us.
Thank you, Evan.
That is really the brilliant Dr. Nana Bennett from the University of Rochester Medical Center, the founder and director of the Center for Community Health and Prevention, co-director of the Clinical and Translational Science Institute. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer of Connections. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. I'm going to go get a flu shot, and I'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.